I'm Randy Rader. In my highest calling, I teach patent law at George Washington University. We have three magnificent scholars and friends of mine who are going to address a topic of great interest. Let me introduce them just to start out. We have Don Martins, who's the signature lead partner, one of the outstanding members of the patent bar, but he is from Kenobi Martins on the West Coast. Scott Keefe is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis and has been the chairman of this section at least once, maybe several times. Scott, I lose track, but you're one of our leaders. And maybe the brightest of all is Artie Rye, who's a professor at Duke University and is just an outstanding contributor in all areas of intellectual property law. Let me start our topic today with a quick story that I used to think have very profound views on this question of specialized courts and their value. And I got a lesson on that at a Federal Judges Association dinner. I was on the executive committee, and we were sitting having dinner with, I was probably with 20 district judges sitting at a large round table. And in my enthusiasm, I said, "Let me ask you all a question. Wouldn't it be wonderful?" I think I said it with that sort of enthusiasm. "Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could assign one district court, perhaps in each region, to handle all the patent cases? They gain expertise in the law and in the science, and everything would work far easier, and it'd take a load off of many of you." I expected a warm response. I just about lost my left hand, if not my right, too. They started one at a time taking after me, saying, "Absolutely not. You can't take my patent cases away. I'm a generalist judge. I can do any kind of law. After you take the patent law cases, will you take the antitrust cases too? And then maybe the copyright cases? And you'll leave me doing nothing but sentencing and immigration, right?" Absolutely not. I was left hanging on my own words. And that becomes maybe the challenging question I would put to my colleagues as they rise. Or they're not going to rise. They're going to speak from here. As they speak, I'd ask them, is the specialized court system at all consistent with our American jurisprudential tradition? How would you respond to my district court colleagues, who were unanimous, by the way, in their opprobrium for this kind of an idea? I think each one of our panelists will speak for 10 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to questions. Let's start with Don Martins, then Scott Keefe, and finally Artie Rye. Don?
Thank you very much, Judge. The title today is Specialized Courts, Lessons from the Federal Circuit. But I kind of want to set that up, put it in context by giving a little history of what were the problems that caused the Federal Circuit to be formed, and then look at, have those problems been alleviated by the Federal Circuit? In the 70s, the regional circuits were just widely variant in the way they looked at patent cases. Some of them were notoriously pro-patent, and some of them were notoriously anti-patent. And as a result, the patent case decisions depended upon geography as much as on the merits. I was trying cases at that time, and principally in the West Coast. And in the Ninth Circuit, there almost was no patent law at the time. The Ninth Circuit was one of the notoriously anti-patent judges, or courts. So forum shopping, of course, became rampant. Patent owners didn't have any confidence in their patent right until they knew where it was going to be litigated. And competitors had the same problem in deciding whether or not they had a freedom to operate. Until they knew where it was going to be litigated, they didn't know. Patent decisions were inconsistent and unreliable. At the same time, this was the early stages of the transition to a global economy in the 70s, and at the same time, there was a great fear among economists and in Congress that the United States was losing its innovative edge. The concern was that we were going into a global economy and the U.S. was going to lose out. There was a perception that R&D was not being done by U.S. companies. They were foregoing it because of the unreliability of the patent system. I know I spent a lot of time then talking to clients not about how to enforce their patents, but whether it was worth getting patents at all, whether it was worth the investment in getting patents because of the way they were being treated in the courts and because of the uncertainty of how they'd be treated in the courts. There was a lot of debate at that time about how to solve it, and pretty soon the focus came to a National Court for Patent Appeals. But there were a lot of concerns about specialty courts, as Judge Rader expressed. And those concerns were principally revolved around isolation of the judges from the general jurisprudence, tunnel vision, possible pro-patent bias of the court, and possible difficulty in attracting judges from various backgrounds rather than just from the patent bar. So the solution Congress adopted was to give the Federal Circuit jurisdiction over other areas of the law in addition to patents. In fact, if I can quote from the Senate report says, quote, "The Federal Circuit will not be a specialized court, as that term is normally used. It will have a varied docket spanning a broad range of legal issues. The judges will have no lack of exposure to a broad variety of legal problems." Now, of course, we know patents were the reason that the court was formed, and patents do, in fact, form the largest part of their docket. But nonetheless, the intent was that it not be specialized, that it have some exposure to other areas of the law and the broader jurisprudence. Now, how has the Federal Circuit done in overcoming these kind of problems? Forum shopping, first of all. Immediately after the Federal Circuit was formed, forum shopping really dropped off. There was no reason to worry about which appellate court was going to be handling it, so it dropped off. It's come back now to a degree as patent owners rushed first to the Eastern District of Virginia's Rocket Docket and then to Delaware and now to the Eastern District of Texas. But forum shopping is, I can say, nowhere near the problem today that it was in the 70s, not even close. In terms of the strength of patents, the court has greatly strengthened patents, especially in the validity and remedies areas. I lived through that transition, and in my view, the Federal Circuit saved the patent system from becoming essentially irrelevant. Because it was, in my view, it was going into the tubes. Yet the Federal Circuit has balanced its pro-patent decisions on validity and remedies with its decisions on infringement, inequitable conduct, Section 112, areas of law where it would be hard to categorize the Federal Circuit as pro-patentee. In terms of attracting judges, the court has attracted a highly diverse and highly competent group of judges from diverse backgrounds, and I don't see tunnel vision as a real problem. Now, on the other hand, the court has tended to be very formalistic. It's been criticized a lot for that. They often develop bright line rules, which sometimes substitute certainty for equity. But certainty was one of the things that the Federal Circuit was formed to improve. So a certain degree of certainty is desirable and necessary. And the Supreme Court has been more than willing to step in when they saw bright line rules that they thought were getting too far, too specific and too far away from the policy behind the patent laws. Reliability and predictability have been greatly improved by the Federal Circuit. There's still a lot of issues that are panel dependent. Even though the court won't openly admit that, I think all practitioners think there are a lot of issues that are still panel-dependent, most notably claim construction. But generally, on most issues, the court's been receptive to going en banc and resolving differences to the best they can. Still can't resolve the differences in the way a particular judge might approach application of the law to the facts, but certainly can resolve differences in the rule of law. And they've been willing to do that, and the Supreme Court has stepped in where the Supreme Court thought it was necessary to do it. It's interesting, the concern when the court was formed was that there wouldn't be enough diversity of views among the judges in a specialty court. It turned out, I think, to be more diversity of views than anybody expected, and a lot of criticism of the court for the diversity of views. So, you know, sometimes you should be careful what you ask for. In sum, no institution's perfect, but I think the Federal Circuit has done a very good job and has been a successful model. I do think it's time to build on that model and make some other institutional changes. One of those is of the type that the Judge Rader talked about. The average district judge, even though they like their total broad docket, the average district judge tries a patent case every 6 or 7 years. They don't have much opportunity to get experience or education. They have no particular training that trains them for handling patent cases. They're faced with a conflicting opinions of technical experts, neither of which they probably are able to understand. There has to be a better solution, irrespective of, I think Judge Rader is correct, judges don't want to have things carved out from them, but I think there has to be a better solution. In the last Congress, Congressman Issa submitted a bill proposing a pilot program for having district court judges who take the load of patent cases in that district. It's a complicated proposal, and I won't go into the details right now. But essentially, it would be in the bigger districts and the busier patent districts would be in the pilot program, and judges would have the opportunity to opt in or opt out of patent cases. And if they opted in for patent cases, then the patent cases in that district would be transferred to them unless the judge to which they were originally signed wanted to keep it. So the theory is that the judges would handle a lot of patent cases, but that there would be enough of them in any district handling it that patent cases would still only be about maybe a third of their docket, and they would have the general jurisprudence. They would have the rounded visibility, the rounded look at other areas of the law. The other place I think that we need institutional change is at the Patent and Trademark Office. Patent and Trademark Office is in a real crisis. They simply cannot handle the volume of patent applications they have, and they can't do an adequate job of examining them. And I think it's not practical to think that we're going to cure that situation. We can improve it. They need more resources. They need to find ways to improve that. But in addition to that, they've got to augment the patent examining system with a post-grant opposition proceeding. And there have been plenty of proposals for that in Congress recently. That is a solution that supplementing a good examination process and supplementing a good court process sort of fills a niche in the middle, a lower-cost way of getting rid of the patents that are clearly or easily invalidated. So, in sum, I think the Federal Circuit and these two institutional changes go a long way to making a very good patent system. You're going to hear some more radical proposals, I think, from my two panel members here, but this is sort of a middle-of-the-road approach that I think will work very well.
Thank you, Don. Scott.
So I think we'll probably end up fighting with each other over middle, because I think probably each of us has in our own minds the view that our positions are middle in some way. I think that when you think about the details of the legal institution, the rules that we're going to set up, and then their enforcement characteristics, I think it's important to then start asking ourselves, what are the types of decisions we society want made? And we're going to muck them up all the time. We're going to be over-inclusive. We're going to be under-inclusive, right? We're going to make both types of errors, and they will be unavoidable to some extent. We should also be vigilant about the costs of those errors, which include not just their frequency, how often do we make them, but how bad of a position do they leave us in when we make them? Can we shoulder some of those errors, even if they're frequent, for example? So then we should ask ourselves, what is the information decision-makers, decision-making bodies need to get in order to make a kind of good decision? Now, I want to make the argument that the patent system is just fundamentally different from other administrative regulatory systems. I think that questions about health and safety, environment, maybe even market regulation are questions about kind of expert judgment. And questions about patent validity, I think, are at bottom questions of fact. Either my lab notebook is dated before yours or it's not. I'm either adding ink to the lab notebook page to forge it or not. That student thesis is available on a library shelf at Reed College, to take a famous case, or at the University of Freiburg, you know, a foreign country's library. It's either there or it's not, and it either was available on a particular date or it's not. Now, I don't think there's an Uber examiner in the world who can go to every college library or go to every world library and depose every librarian and find that information. So I think the information needed to assess patent validity is really pure play factual information. And we have an organization in this country that is developed carefully to decide questions of fact. And while it sounds crazy to submit to a lay jury a seemingly complex technological question involved in patent cases, we do because they're good at finding facts. And it's no different to decide whether on the facts I was first or you were first than it is to decide whether I pulled the trigger or not in a murder case, or whether, you know, your car hit mine in a tort case. And so I think that the real underlying questions in the first instance of patent validity are questions of fact, and the best place to adjudicate those are before general federal courts, applying the federal rules of civil procedure and having federal rules of evidence govern the admissibility of the evidence, and have juries, when requested, decide them, and when not, federal judges, reviewable for fact-finding clear error. I think that, and of course for law, de novo. And so I think that then on appeal, the case for the specialization goes up a little bit. And I applaud, I do think that the discussion of the Federal Circuit's history and the way it's played out is accurate. And I'll, you know, incorporate that then, you know, herein by reference, to take a patent law term, and move on then to the next topic, which is to say, okay, so then what about specialization within a federal court? You know, if there are 10 judges in a particular district and 3 of them like patent cases, I see no problem with that degree of specialization. What I'm nervous about is formal specialization in the court system or in the administrative agencies, specialization of the type that would require administrative deference because I think that that administrative deference opens up the door to people who think that they are expert, substituting their personal preferences and judgment, the type of which that can be hugely influenced by politics, for fact questions. And so we inject another type of error into the system, pure play political influence and lobbying. And that converts the patent system from a system designed to facilitate competition to one that actually frustrates competition by being a tool for influence. Now, I'm not making the argument that all regulatory bodies are corrupt. I'm making the argument that we in society rationally choose to bear the potential for that type of influence in bodies of law where we're rationally choosing and we're knowingly choosing to say to ourselves, this is really about expert judgment. So in this area of law, we want an administrator to be making decisions and we want her to get APA deference and Chevron deference. But I think we should recognize that we bear those costs because we're getting that benefit. And I don't think that benefit is available in the patent system because it's fundamentally a different question that we're asking ourselves. So I think that then on the last question about second look, a hard look, gold-plated, I think that different ways to review patents, opposition, reexamination, and so forth. I think that we have fundamentally a set of concerns. You want people who are facing the threat or presence of litigation to be able to get out of those cases if there's no genuine issue of material fact or no ability to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. And for those of you who memorize your civil procedure, you notice that we have baked all of that into the federal rules of civil procedure, as we have baked into the rules of civil procedure notions of joinder and preclusion so that you don't get held up in repetitive process. And so I think that reproducing a adjudicatory system through second look, third look, hard look, in fact, puts us back into the world before the federal rules of civil procedure where we don't have highly developed mechanisms for mitigating those concerns that both sides of the potential V, in fact, do have. And so the federal rules do a nice job of dealing with those issues. My response is to say, if you think that one size does not fit all in the patent system, I cannot possibly believe you think one more size will do the trick. Right? So second look is not going to be that much better than single look. What's nice about the federal rules of civil procedure is it's an infinite number of sizes. Thanks.
Thank you, Scott. Artie.
So first of all, I want to thank the folks at the Federal Society for inviting me. This is a wonderful panel, and I'll be very brief in the interest of getting to the good part, which is the discussion with the audience and among the panel members. So Scott has already, and Don, have already alluded to the role of administrative agencies. And I actually teach administrative law in addition to teaching patent law. And my background as a litigator was at the Department of Justice, where I worked defending administrative agencies. So I'm glad that we've engaged the questions of administrative law already. From the perspective of boilerplate administrative law, now whether patents should be within the boilerplate administrative law system or not is a good question that I'll talk about a little more in a moment, and I may differ with Scott a little bit on that question. As many of you probably know, from the perspective of boilerplate administrative law, specialization and expertise is generally the province of administrative agencies, and then they're reviewed with various levels of deference by generalist courts. Deference is particularly acute in the administrative law system on questions of fact-finding and on so-called mixed questions of fact and law, the idea there being that facts are the sorts of things that agencies do a particularly good job on because they have the expertise, the scientific facts in particular. And I think this is where Scott and I may differ a little bit. I'm not sure that the facts in the patent system are the facts of the sort, are not primarily the facts of the sort that he's talking about what date or date stamp a particular lab experiment had. In addition to those sorts of facts, we often have to deal with much more complex fact-finding that does require the application of judgment. So what is the ordinary skill in the art in a particular area of science or technology? What would be obvious to the ordinary person having ordinary skill in the art? I don't think that the average lay jury is going to do that particularly well in an area of, in most areas of complex science and technology, you know, whether it be nanotechnology or synthetic biology or what have you. So I think that there are reasons to think that the boilerplate administrative model at a very high level at 30,000 feet does have some application to patent law, that it's not so different with the kind of complex fact-finding that's done in administrative, in patent law is not that different from some of the complex fact-finding regarding epidemiology or what have you that might be done by the EPA or the FDA. Now, an argument that has not been raised yet but I think is an interesting one is that, well, patent law is different and shouldn't follow the ordinary administrative model because patents are property rights. And as a consequence of that, the work of the PTO is fundamentally different from that of other agencies. Scott has alluded to this a little bit by suggesting, well, we don't want the system to be subject to the whims of different administrations, to political pressures, to what is often termed in the administrative law literature the problem of capture by well-represented special interest groups, particularly because we're talking about property rights, which are perhaps different from what most other agencies deal with. And I think that's an interesting argument, but there are two responses that I'd have. First of all, I'm not entirely sure that patents are the sort of Blackstonian property rights that some people think that they are. And then secondly, other agencies also allocate things that look a lot like property rights, whether it be rights to broadcast on a particular piece of spectrum or a lot of different types of allocations that could be, if one has a relatively capacious view of what property is, could be considered property. In addition, in some ways, if a patent is a property right, that could be seen as even more reason to give an agency, which is the first actor in the system, more of the power, because if we want, as most people think we do, certainty and notice and predictability with respect to property rights, the agency is the first actor in the system, so if we want really, really early certainty and predictability, a good agency can provide that better than a court system, which necessarily acts ex post rather than ex ante. So, again, on the 30,000 feet level, one might think, well, you know, we have an agency. It's not immediately obvious that we shouldn't do more to strengthen the agency as opposed to having more specialization in the court system. But that, of course, is at a 30,000 feet level. Historically, as people on the panel well know, the PTO has not been viewed as so competent. It's been viewed as a weak agency that has a lot of problems, and I think accurately so, a weak agency with a lot of problems. So the idea has been it would be foolhardy to give them a lot of power and deference, even in the area of fact-finding where agencies generally get a lot of power and deference. So as a practical matter, the real work of both fact-finding and legal development has been done by the courts. And as Don pointed out, when the evidence suggested that appellate courts were taking widely divergent views on the legal questions, there was perceived to be a need to get more certainty and specialization, predictability through specialization in the courts rather than, for example, enhancing the power of the PTO and having all courts then defer, which would be another way of getting certainty and predictability early on. In other systems, what we have is specialization in the court system as well. So it's not an entirely strange idea to have specialization in the court system within patents. However, in other countries, it's typically done at the trial court level, with generalist courts then deferring to what the specialized trial court has done. And that yields a slightly higher, earlier level of certainty and predictability because the trial court obviously comes before the appellate court. In the UK system, there's some empirical evidence that having a specialized trial court then reviewed by a generalist appellate court does provide some level of certainty and predictability a little bit earlier on, and the generalist court does defer to a significant degree to the specialized trial court. Now, in all sorts of in these sorts of comparisons to other countries, one has to be careful because we're talking about very different systems. But it is interesting that in the UK system, the specialized trial court seems to have been perceived as a modest success, even when it's reviewed by a generalist appellate court. Now, what we have in the U.S., obviously, is the reverse. We have specialization at the appellate level, and I think really for good reason. When you have a specialist appellate level court, they're going to be less likely to use the ordinary rules of civil procedure and rely upon them to defer on questions of fact finding, for example, defer to the trial court on questions of fact finding. But as a consequence, certainty and predictability, even though the Federal Circuit was set up to create certainty and predictability, I think it has in some respects. By definition, if fact-finding is not something that the appellate court defers on, at least in some cases, you're not going to get certainty and predictability until the appellate court weighs in, which is pretty late in the process. So that's an issue. That's just an issue with respect to having a specialist appellate court, because it's not likely to defer as much to inferior actors in the system simply because it thinks, and probably rightly so, that it has more knowledge than many of the inferior actors in the system. So one possibility would be to fix the problem through clear guidelines, for example, to lower courts on, for example, claim construction. I'm not sure that is necessarily going to work, however, because in lots of areas, no matter how clear the guidelines, reasonable minds can probably differ about their application in a particular case. And claim construction, I think, is a good example of that. So the real problem is not necessarily coming up with precise guidelines, because it'll be almost impossible to do so in some cases, but deciding who the primary authority for interpretation of the guidelines is. So it's a power allocation decision as opposed to trying to make something clear that almost by definition can't be 100% clear, and where reasonable minds can always differ. I think these are interesting. As a consequence, we have a set of interesting puzzles, and now we have the Supreme Court weighing in into the equation, I think primarily because, as Don indicated, they've been concerned that perhaps the attempts to get clarity through these really precise guidelines, formalistic guidelines, has not been successful, has, first of all, not yielded the clarity that we would want, and secondly, doesn't take into account policy considerations. And the Supreme Court has also, I think, perceived not necessarily a pro-patent bias, but in some cases perceived the Federal Circuit to be taking patent law in an area that diverges from other areas of law. So, for example, in the remedies context, the perception in the eBay case was that the Federal Circuit had made a special law of remedies for patents, which wasn't exactly what the Supreme Court thought would be appropriate. So that's where we are, and we've got, I think I too will be in fighting for claiming the mantle of moderation. We've got, I think, a pretty good system, so long as the Supreme Court is maintaining some vigilance over the process. I'm not sure now that they've done their bit that they will continue to maintain vigilance. We'll see, and that worries me a little bit, that they'll get bored of patents and, you know, go off and not look at the area for a long time. But so far, I think we've got a pretty healthy balance, and so I would be wary of really radical proposals so long as the Supreme Court is maintaining some level of interest in the system.
Thank you. Let's applaud all three. Scott, you want to start off with a comment?
I'll try to join directly some of the issues that Artie Rye raised, if that's helpful.
Sure, go ahead.
So I think that the points that you make about property and you know the FCC, for example, I think there are a lot of us who study kind of comparative and approaches to different institutional designs, and we would say, for example, that what the FCC does could be lumped together with property, but it could be not, and that Some of my colleagues and I have written papers about what we call kind of property at its best and property at its worst, and we would kind of say that patents, when functioning well, are property at their best. That the other things you're describing, we would call regulatory entitlements, and yeah, they can be traded with each other to some extent, but nowhere nearly to the degree that a well-functioning kind of property right can be. So I agree that you want, you know, some degree of certainty, but certainty doesn't, I'm not sure that it has to be at the launch point the way you described it. I mean, so the patent office is the first actor, but maybe it's only making a first cut. Now, does that mean that so-called paper patents would be shockingly unpredictable because large numbers of them are getting invalidated by courts? I don't know. I mean, even after the recent crash in our capital markets, we still have the Dow up at 8,000. They're still the largest capital market in the history of the world, created around a filing system where the receiving office publishes the filings on the web, Edgar. It doesn't carefully examine them for merit. It examines them for form and for fraud. But the SEC doesn't do kind of merits-based examination, and yet markets manage to order themselves around that stuff because markets can get access to the information they need to create the degree of certainty you're describing. And so in the patent setting, I disagree with your definitional point about calling obviousness or ordinary skill in the art a fact question. I call that a judgment call. And the drafters, the degree of specialization that I think Don talked about was at the appellate court level was a degree of specialization about the history, for example, of 103 and the history of obviousness and the decision to pick a new word, obviousness, that was different from the old word invention, not because either of those two words has objectively any more clear of a meaning than the other, but because there was an immense amount of interpretive baggage associated with the old word invention, and we wanted to inject new interpretive guidelines, and so we picked a new word and we drafted the statute to constrain the decision makers interpreting that new word to force them to focus on the facts, not to substitute their own judgment. And so I think, regrettably, the Supreme Court overlooked that history precisely because it lacked the degree of appellate specialization and lacked the benefit of the learning we did through history. And so on the comparison to foreign countries question, and then I'll end, I think that we in the U.S. have a ridiculously expensive discovery process where people swap terabytes of information they're required to through litigation, right? And that's really costly, and that sounds bad, but there are some benefits. The benefits that come from it are that private parties are exchanging information that is then verifiable because they know sanctions and maybe even jail time will come if they lie. And so the information collectively gets injected into both sides of the lawsuit so they can decide, is this patent really valid? And I think you want people to have incentives to swap that information with each other, patentee to say to the alleged infringer, hey, buddy, here are the reasons why you're infringing, and the infringer to say to the patentee, hey, buddy, here's why your patent's invalid. And then if we stay in court, we're really engaged in bad faith litigation. I think this is a litigation abuse problem, not a patent abuse problem.
Let me involve the audience here for a second. One of the fundamental issues we're debating is whether there should be specialized district courts, trial courts, like in England. How many here, if they were in the United States Senate, would vote for a few regional specialized patent district courts? How many would say yes? How many would say no? The no's decidedly have it.
Don,
go ahead.
I don't think that's the issue.
All right, go ahead.
I would be opposed to a specialist patent court that handled just patent cases. I would not be opposed, I would favor district court judges who have about a third of their docket patent cases all over the country.
Let's restate the question for Don's benefit. How many would allow one district in each circuit to handle the patent cases along with the rest of their docket?
That isn't
one,
exactly
two, how, hold them up high. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
How many would prefer to leave the system as it is with every district court capable of handling a patent case? Raise your hand. Well, now see, that did change the equation, Don. That went the other way.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I along that line, the difficulty is, Scott talks about it's a simple fact, what's the date on this document versus what's the date on the other document. And that is a simple fact. That's summary judgment material. But the facts in a patent case in trial are not that simple, because you read this complex technical document and you read the patent application and the claims, and you've got to decide whether they match. And they don't use the same language, and they don't describe it in the same way. You've got to understand what the patent is talking about, and you've got to understand what the document, prior art document, is talking about in order to decide whether they match. That's a complex fact determination. It is a fact determination, but it's a very complex fact determination. And the more patent you have handled, the more you have looked at those kinds of issues, the greater likelihood there is that you'll resolve that fact, that question right.
Let's challenge your opening remarks a little bit, Don. You say the Federal Circuit was created to solve a certain problem.
Right.
Well, why can't we argue the Federal Circuit has corrected the problem? We should now fold it back into the District of Columbia Circuit, or maybe fold it into the Ninth Circuit and have more than one Federal Circuit, let regional circuits handle patent cases again. Federal Circuit's already solved the problem. What do you think?
Go ahead, Scott.
I would say until 30 months ago, I would have bought that argument. I think we've actually radically changed the patent system in the last 30 months through judicial determination at the Federal Circuit and Supreme Court level. If pressed on this, I actually would have said that kind of we had reached a high point, and we've now already started to meaningfully descend from those heights over the last 30 months.
Don?
I think the problem is the Federal Circuit has solved the problems, but the Federal Circuit has solved the problems by virtue of its existence. You take it away and you spread it around to three or four regional districts or regional courts, and you get the same problem as you had before you formed the Federal
Circuit. But you suggested the Federal Circuit's become a part of the problem, too.
Well,
with its panel dependence, and there were a few other things you mentioned.
That problem.
Why, couldn't we
that
solve
problem,
that?
Pardon?
Couldn't we solve that? Just fold it back into the District of Columbia.
You're not going to solve it. You're just going to move it.
And you'll make it harder to find. Yeah. So at least now it's concentrated in one court, and we can focus our attention on that and separate our efforts to address that problem from the more complex, thorny problems of debating appellate process that occur, as we all well know, in the context of how should we shape the circuit bench across the country generally, and how do we feel about commercial cases versus criminal cases. There are a range of broader social policies that heaven forbid would be worse, I think, to inject into our debate about the Federal Circuit.
Well, I think the other thing to think about in these contexts is transition problems. So Fritz Machlup, an economist who studied the patent system, famously said of the patent system, well, we don't know whether it's good or bad for innovation, but now that we have it, we may as well keep it. And I think, with the Federal Circuit, it's done a reasonable job. I'm glad that, contrary to, I think here Scott and I also differ significantly, I'm glad the Supreme Court has been interested in thinking about whether in certain cases there need to be formalistic rules or and or rules special to the patent system. So I'm glad it has stepped in. But I think, you know, on balance, the Federal Circuit has done a reasonable job, and eliminating at this stage would create huge transition problems and huge amounts of uncertainty, unpredictability, and the like. So now that we have it, I think it's probably a reasonable idea to keep it. You know, whether de novo, if we were creating the country all over again, we would do a lot of the things we've done in terms of our court system. These are open questions, but I don't think that, again, as long as the Supreme Court is interested in, given that we're not going to have the ordinary circuit splits in patent law, the Supreme Court has to rely upon other signals, and it's so long as it's interested in relying upon those other signals, whether they be the SG's office or other signals on Bach rulings and the like, I think, you know, we're in pretty good shape. And here, I suspect, again, Scott differs significantly from me.
Professor Rye, while we have you, what about Professor Duffy's proposal mm-hmm. that we have more than one federal circuit to solve some of the problems of a single circuit handling patent law?
So I'm glad you asked that, because I was going to talk about that proposal, but I didn't want to go on for too long. So Professor Duffy and Professor Nard, respectively of GW and Case Western, have this idea that one of the difficulties with a specialized court is not so much specialization per se, but lack of competition. So from their standpoint, competition would, from other similarly specialized courts, would help and would tee up issues for Supreme Court review, would do all sorts of things that would maintain the virtues of specialization while also injecting into the system some of the virtues of decentralization, because they think the problem is centralization as opposed to specialization. You know, At this stage, I do think that the Supreme Court, with respect to the centralization question in particular, the Supreme Court is sufficiently aware of cues with respect to disagreement in the Federal Circuit or disagreement with how the Federal Circuit has viewed things, that it doesn't need the cue of a circuit split. Now, that might change in the future, but it seems to me, to the extent the argument is that the Supreme Court would really be helped by the cue of a circuit split and, you know, having the issues teed up through that circuit split, I'm not sure that that's really necessary. It seems to me the SG's office does a pretty good job of when in those cases when it goes before the Supreme Court on patent cases of teeing up the relevant questions pretty well for the court.
Don, two or three federal circuits?
No, I think two or three federal circuits just compounds the problem. We have plenty of disagreement among the judges in the single court and the Federal Circuit, and they tee it up very well for the Supreme Court through dissents, mm-hmm. Through differing panel decisions. We are not lacking for differences of opinion among the judges. So why take it to two or three different courts where you simply expand the differences of opinions and differences of application? That's going the wrong direction.
Let's turn to our audience. Does anyone wish to inquire?
I have two questions, if that's permitted.
Sure.
The first question is prompted by something that Professor Keefe said about the nature of the validity determination in the patent area and it being more appropriate for judicial rather than administrative determination. If that's true, I wonder whether you think we should get rid of the presumption of validity and the clear and convincing evidence standard, particularly since I think the level at which patent decisions are made in PTO is a relatively low level compared to the types of decisions that other agencies make that get deference, and yet that initial decision receives quite a great a high degree of deference.
Short answer is absolutely yes.
I don't know that I would go so far as to get rid of the presumption. I would make sure that we understand that it is procedural and not substantive. You could do that with a tiny amendment to 282, and even I think the Federal Circuit could do it in interpreting 282 to say simply that the person challenging validity has to go so far as to utter, "I challenge validity." But, you know, other than that, it's a mere preponderance of the evidence standard is the substantive burden. So I totally agree and have advocated for that in writing. I'll also just mention it, that I have kind of long and short papers on that topic and on the property versus regulatory topic and on each of these topics available for easy download on the web page out at Hoover where we run this big project on commercializing innovation. And for those of you who want to go look, it's just www.innovation.hoover.org. And short and long versions of all of that stuff, but I very much agree, yes.
Don or Artie, do you agree with the clear and convincing standard?
I have written several articles criticizing the clear and convincing standard. I think it came out of thin air when it was developed by the Federal Circuit. I think the statute was intended only to mean who has the burden, not how heavy that burden should be.
And here we have a point of disagreement among the whole panel, I think. I would say that the 282 actually adds nothing to the APA in terms of it's just kind of boilerplate language. All agency action is presumed valid. And under default APA standards, there are good reasons to believe that you shouldn't give much deference to a garden variety patent determination. Now, I've been an advocate in writing of tiering, of having garden variety patent determinations and then other types of patent determinations that are not garden variety, which, again, under default principles of administrative law, would get more deference. But I think the current garden variety standard patent determination, for lots of good reasons, should get a very minimal amount of deference.
Did you have a second question?
I did. The second question is, we have sort of a strange system in that we have, as has been discussed, generalized trial courts and then a somewhat specialist intermediate appellate court and then the Supreme Court. And, of course, for the first 20 years or so, the Supreme Court largely kept its hands off and lately has not. And so the question is, among the three possible regimes for Supreme Court review, which would be the one we have now, de novo review of Federal Circuit decisions, or a deferential type review on the theory that the Federal Circuit is specialized in the patent area, or no review at all, which would presumably be something Congress could do, but which is the right approach?
I don't know that. So I'm hugely critical of the Supreme Court action in this area. Okay, and yet even from that perspective, I don't know that I would change the law. I would plea to the court to please take the time to read what folks who have thought about this before you, the great justices on the Supreme Court, get these 15 minutes to think about it. Because while you're shockingly bright people, you're not that bright that you might not benefit from at least reading the history of the experiments we've tried and the reasons why they failed and the reasons why we've chosen, for example, to statutorily jettison bodies of your case law. So I would say, if we the people speak through Congress to change what you, the Supreme Court, are doing, please notice that. Please read. Please pay attention. And if you want to tell us that we've acted in a way that is unconstitutional, hey, no problem. If you want to challenge us because you think, on the facts, we got it wrong, then we all have to go back to the trial. The Supreme Court's not the place to fix that. So I think that my criticism of the Supreme Court action in this area is nothing more than a form of kind of old-fashioned, either they're acting like policymakers or like jurors, and criticism of the Supreme Court. And I think I don't think anyone on the left or right of the kind of center of the political spectrum would disagree with that as a criticism of the Supreme Court. They might think it's not doing that in particular cases, but they would say, if it's doing that, that's bad.
I think that's a great question. It's very interesting because with the Federal Circuit, we've set up a situation where you have a court that acts more like an agency in some respects than in your typical system. It's almost as if you've got an appellate agency of sorts. So one could make the administrative type arguments for deference, I think, there. Having said that, I'd be reluctant to make them as a formal matter of law. I think the Supreme Court could keep those kind of background principles of deference, however, in mind when it reviews the Federal Circuit, which is probably not too distant from what Scott is talking about, interestingly enough. Another point of agreement, that even though the law formally shouldn't change, I don't think, to accommodate the nature of the Federal Circuit, that there is a certain amount of caution that the Supreme Court should exercise in reviewing the Federal Circuit, perhaps more caution than in the context of other circuits.
That it could review, but I think what we're saying is still pay attention. Ideas matter. I mean, they're either good ideas or they're not, and then institutions matter. You're either a Supreme Court that's supposed to apply law or make law. And so, you know, try to apply it, not to make it, and then try to pay attention to ideas, and then, you know, hey, look, if we disagree with you on particular cases, you know, you're the judges, we're not, you know, you win.
Don, you wanted to address this.
Yeah, well, just a little bit on deference. You know, there are two kinds of deference, I think. One is express deference, whereas as a matter of standard, you give deference. And the other is just a subjective deference, where you give deference because you respect what happened below. And I think what we're saying is that's the kind of deference that the Supreme Court should be giving to the Federal Circuit, not procedural deference. And I think the same thing is true with between the Federal Circuit and the district courts. I just think that the Federal Circuit would give more deference to the district courts if the district court judges had more experience trying patent cases.
Let me throw in another question here. If this conference were being held in Tokyo or Beijing, the central question of the day would have to do with the system and how we adjudicate patent cases. But their question would be, can a jury really handle monoclonal antibodies? Artie?
I'm on record as being, it's become very controversial, the fact that I'm on record about this, as being very skeptical of juries in the patent system. I think that there are actually ways, so that's as a policy matter. Now, as a matter of law, whether we can restrict juries from doing what is in many cases fact-finding, I think, is a difficult question. I've said, and this is the part that's been controversial, that I think that there are ways consistent with the Seventh Amendment of doing that, but you know, that's an area where reasonable minds can definitely differ. But I think as a policy matter, there's no question about it, in my view.
Yeah,
Don?
Having been before a lot of juries, I don't think they can understand it. I think that what you do as a trial lawyer is you simplify it. We like to say you get it down to the eighth grade level. I think what you do is you get it to the USA Today level, where it's color charts, but it doesn't really. You aren't dealing with the real facts when you do that. You're dealing with a simplification of the facts. One side simplifies them one way, and the other side simplifies them the other way, a different way. And the jury decides based on who did the best job of simplifying them to a way they can understand, rather than on the facts.
I am very sympathetic to those concerns, and in fact wrote a long time ago with Les Mizrock a paper arguing a range of ways to do what Artie's suggesting, to kind of address the Seventh Amendment concerns and to have either specialized juries. Remember, the Seventh Amendment is a preserving right, not a granting right, and so it preserves the right to juries that we had at the time of founding. The Sixth Amendment, the criminal jury amendment, is a granting. And so if you go back and look what the British courts were doing with patent cases, Lord Mansfield was taking
complex commercial cases, including patent cases, before what he called special juries, merchant juries in London, jurors who were of the peers of the technology or of the business. I think that in present U.S. practice, because of anti-discrimination laws, you'd have to make sure that the jury was not special in being, you know, all black, all white, all male, all female, but it could be special in being, you know, all technically trained, for example. So I'm open to that. That having been said, I really have shifted over the years away from that view, out of the great fear that the more specialized the decision maker is, the more she is inevitably willing to use her own views rather than the facts of the record. And I think the sum of the error costs in this case cut in favor of constraining ourselves, of tying ourselves to the mast. Ulysses knew that he would be swayed by the siren's song, and so he lashed himself to the mast. We should know that when we put experts into the box, inevitably, they see friends in the audience. They recognize that through informal networks, they're connected to one side of the case or the other. They use proxy decision making. And while lay juries make errors in some ways, I think the errors that these types of people will make in this way are more pernicious, because I think they ultimately boil down to being fundamentally fashion-driven or capture-driven, and the capture problems, I think, are too great.
Just one observation. I'm not sure how it affects the expert analysis of both of our panelists here, but I've tried many cases as a trial judge with a jury. On one occasion, I decided to be very innovative, and I selected a blue panel jury where no one on the jury had less than a college education, except for one. She was in her senior year studying the topic of our patent. That's the only jury that I've ever had to reverse as a judge on JMAL. Just an observation. I don't know. There was another question out here.
Hi, I'm Mark Schultz. I'm chair of the IP practice group. And when we chose the topic this year for the convention panel, one thing that motivated me was a little bit of curiosity as to what our panelists might say about the fact that other lawyers often argue that their specialty deserves a court like the Federal Circuit. I've heard this recently from a labor lawyer. Our field's a mess. We need our own specialized appellate court. So the question I ask is our beloved subject matter, I'm asking the wrong guys, of course, is our beloved subject matter sui generis, so we deserve a specialty court? Or are there other subject areas that perhaps could deserve a specialty court? And what would be the criteria? Does the experience of the Federal Circuit counsel for or against it?
I was going to touch on that in my opening remarks, but I didn't want to spend too much time. The Congress, when they adopted the Federal Circuit, made it very clear that they considered this a very special circumstance, and they weren't looking to make other specialties. They looked at patents and saw that the economy was in big trouble because of an inadequate patent judicial system. And so they were focused not on the problems of patent law. They were focused on the problems that improper management of the patent law was having on the economy as a whole. So I think you have to look at it, and I think that was good judgment. I think you have to look at it in that context, not, gee, is this area of law need a specialty court, but does this area of law need a specialty court because it's causing serious social problems?
Yeah, I echo that. I am open to the view that is, I think, most clearly laid out in the Justice White report on specialized courts, which is the view that, so he lays it out more clearly than I will right now, which is that you could imagine, for example, commercial areas of law. Now, you know, that's a sloppy term. But I think by that what we mean would be patent, trademark, copyright, antitrust, bankruptcy, might all go to a federal circuit.
the Federal Circuit, in fact, I believe is the suggestion in the report, but you could expand the court if it needed more members in order to take that added case law. The idea, and maybe another court, but the idea there is that what so much of what is driving decision making in Congress to shape the courts and in the courts is a range of social policies that I think are that at least even those of us who are very, very nervous about so-called policy arguments in court would be open to in an area, in some areas of law, but in other areas of law, we might think that market actors need a degree of objectivity and predictability, and that simple rules for a complex life actually can be really important in commercial areas of law. And so you might want more economically oriented judges, more self-restrained judges, fewer judicial activists kind of applying those commercial areas. And I think that would be the case for lumping all of those bodies of law together. And I think, for those you want to read more about it, I think it's the White Report that talks about that and the debates around it.
Other questions, sir? You have the whoever has the mic, doesn't matter.
Okay, sorry about that. If the goal is, I think the goal here is to get better results at the earliest possible stage, get predictability. How much of, and people have alluded to this already, but how much of the responsibility or the burden do you place on the trial lawyers themselves? And I think this goes to both Professor Schultz's point and the judge's point about, can juries understand nanotechnology, or do other areas of law deserve their own special courts? Because it seems to me that, God, I came to patent law as a generalist, I've been a federal prosecutor. You ask juries to understand DEA chemical analysis in a drug case. You ask juries to understand securities and accounting in financial cases, products liability cases. But we do, at least our group seems to think we're special, and so I think that the trial lawyers need to do a better job, and I'm curious to know what you think about that.
Well, I would say that that's Art Gollwitzer, who's a former colleague of mine, and so I guess in that sense I should reveal he's like a plant in the audience. You know, that's a softball question to me. I applaud that. I mean, I think that trial lawyers do a far better job than we give them credit for, and at least I think very, very good trial lawyers do. And we met working together at a trial firm, and the paper that I wrote earlier kind of arguing against lay juries in patent cases was when I worked at a specialty patent firm. So I think that my views really have shifted as I've come to work with really top trial folks, you know, like you and our other colleagues at that firm and at other firms who can get a jury to understand complex technologies. They won't do it perfectly, but I think that that's what good trial lawyers can do. So I do have that faith, and even though I originally trained as a patent lawyer.
Thanks. Next question?
Actually, my question is related to that, and that is that there's a certain historicism in this question, can juries understand monoclonal antibodies? Because throughout the entire patent system, you've had juries who've been asked to try to understand vast cutting-edge technology. In 1910, I guarantee that very few people sitting at the trial of Wright and Curtis had ever seen an airplane, and they were being asked to understand it. And in the 1880s, very few juries had seen a working light bulb or understood electricity. Or in the 1840s and 50s, very few people had seen a functioning, working sewing machine and understood the mechanics behind it. And yet they're being constantly asked to understand that, and they did. And in fact, as you go further back in history, you find the same complaints of how can juries understand this? This is complex, not what they used to call natural philosophy. They're not schooled. You know, these are farmers and, you know, trade shop apprentices, and they're being asked to decide these complex cases. So to what extent does the argument for specialized courts or specialized district courts or specialized administrative agencies stand or fall on this claim about the inability of lay people, and particularly juries, to understand these difficult fact questions in complex technologies?
Well, I think they're two separate questions, really. Juries or judges that have some experience trying patent cases. That's what I'm advocating, is judges that have experience trying patent cases. That's a different question from do we eliminate juries or don't we? I do agree that a good trial lawyer can do a better job of getting a jury to understand the technology than a poor trial lawyer, but I've done it and seen it enough to be a cynic and to think that the good trial lawyer is really getting to understand his client's side of the tech, his client's spin on the technology, not to understand the technology, but to understand his or her client's spin on the technology. And a good trial lawyer can do that very, very well. But I'm not sure that is giving the right result. It depends so much on the skill of the trial lawyer and so little on the merits of the case.
What about his point, Don, that juries have for years gotten it? And we've trusted them for years, and they seem to have done the job.
Yeah, and I guess...
Well, first of all, juries are used many, many, many more times now in patent cases than they were historically. The percentage of jury trials is a way up. I mean, the reason when I started practicing, jury trials were not common in patent cases.
To follow up on that, I totally agree with what you're saying now, that jury trials today are radically more frequent than they were in this, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago. But are they radically more than they were 80 or 100 years ago? I don't think so. In fact, I think the opposite. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. But I can't speak for whether juries were doing a good job or a poor job 80 years ago. I can speak for what was happening 40 years ago and 30 years ago. And 40 years ago, at first, juries were not being used in patent cases because there was a concern that they didn't understand. Then the circuit courts, the regional circuits, got throwing out so many patents that patent lawyers started using juries because it was harder to overturn the jury verdict and because they felt they could have a better shot at getting validity. So I think I can't tell you about 120 years ago, but I think that the history today is juries are not truly understanding the technology. They're understanding the attorney's spin on the technology.
Did they really handle more in 1880, yeah, and did they do it better, Professor Keefe?
Yeah, well, let me make a comment on that and hand the mic back in a sec. Right. So, I think that the real brain trust in the room is at that table with Professor Schultz and Mossoff and other professors. So I'll defer to Professor Mossoff in particular on this point, who is kind of the leading expert on the history of the U.S. patent system. My only comment I'll add before handing the mic back is that it is to me one of the most kind of ridiculous arguments that is made about the patent system, that we need to update it to deal with new technologies. Well, I think it is really evocative to kind of get people to think about, dead white men in one image, and then, the framers of the Constitution, and then, modern biotech in the other image, and say, gosh, this is so incongruous, these things can't go together. So therefore, law has to be updated to deal with a modern society. I think that argument is probably available for lots of areas of law, but the one area where it cannot possibly be available is patent law, because anticipated technologies are what patent law is all about. That's why we have the law of anticipation, to make anticipated technologies not patentable. It's only unanticipated technologies that are patentable. Patent law was designed for the unanticipated technologies. And so that argument cannot be in any way relevant to patent law.
I agree with that.
Go ahead, Adam.
Thank you. Is there...
Just to follow up on the historical point real quickly, the 19th century historical record, it's mixed on this point, because you still have the bifurcation of law and equity courts. And so if you sued for an injunction, you went to federal equity court. I mean, this is pre-federal rules of civil procedure, where they merged the law and equity courts at the federal level in the 1930s. So But for validity decisions, those had to go to those. That was deemed to be a legal decision that had to go to federal law court and had to have it and had to have a jury trial because that was a question.
For your own lost profits and for validity, both sides of the case had a reason to go to law.
Yes.
And the plaintiff, if he wanted the other side's profits in accounting or an injunction, then he would choose equity.
Right. And so the record's mixed in whether you had more jury trials or not because you had a different structure where you went to actually the federal equity court to get your preliminary injunction. Sometimes before you got before then you had to go to a separate law court to get your trial. So it's difficult to assess whether there were more jury trials or not.
But is it fair to say that when they went to law, they always asked for a jury or almost
essentially,
always?
Essentially, yes. And the judges themselves often complain about the fact that they themselves, I mean, these are, you know, 40, 50, 60-year-old men who, you know, they didn't study mechanics. They didn't study natural philosophy is what it was called back then. And you know, they studied law. You know, they read Blackstone and James Kent and Montesquieu. And so and they would comment in their opinions on appeal how it's crazy that they're being asked to decide these cases sometimes because they don't know any better. And this is very complex, difficult stuff. And one actual case from the 1850s involving sewing machines, one deposition transcript was 3,500 pages long. And this is the 1850s, you know, before computers, typewriters even. I mean, imagine having to compile that transcript and get it ready for trial. It's really complex issues. And we tend to forget that when we talk about, now we're dealing with monoclonal antibodies, now we're dealing with biotech and EST and things like that.
Next question. Professor?
I'd like to change the subject if I could. We've implied here that all the issues that in a patent case or that come before the Federal Circuit are patent issues. And I'd suggest to you that very often cases involve more than patent issues.
Yes.
And yet the collateral issues, the related issues, get decided. For example, there are a number of issues of antitrust and its relation to IP that are presented in a patent case and thus come before the Federal Circuit. The more general question I'm trying to ask is there a risk that when you take non-specialized issues before a specialized tribunal, you're either going to get less good decisions on those issues because the specialized judges are less familiar with them, or that you're going to tend to privilege the patent issues, the specialized issues, that those will become the more important, and that the values or the policies in the collateral or the related subjects will be given less weight than they might appropriately be and might be given in another circuit.
Interestingly enough, though, in that area, the Supreme Court, this is an area where the Supreme Court, I think, has actually been of the view that the Federal Circuit's jurisprudence is totally consistent with the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. So the International Inc. ITW case, I can never remember all the what all the I's stand for in that case, but it's you know, it's a case that adjudicates the narrow question in the case is a patent a presumption of market power, but the broader discussion in the case is quite consistent with the Berger Court's discussion in Dawson, which is quite consistent with the Federal Circuit's discussion of the 271D kind of broad set of topics, which are the IP antitrust interface, and that's totally consistent with the legislative history on 271. And so I think that from back in the 50s and the 40s. So I actually would say, interestingly enough, that's an area where at least I think the Federal Circuit's getting it right, and the Supreme Court thinks the Federal Circuit's getting it right.
Now, I would agree with the implication of the question, though, that there is a danger there. But you have to weigh that danger against the advantages of having the specialized court decide what it's deciding. And I'd agree with Scott that the way it's gone, that danger hasn't seemed to have come to fruition.
Next question. I think it's over here.
Yeah. I'd like to raise an issue. I don't know if it's off topic or not. I don't think it is. A problem that a lot of my clients recognize and I think is really hurting the patent system in general. It is just too expensive to litigate patent cases. We routinely tell clients that if they don't have $1 million, don't bother. I have a client who has infringement litigation going on. The judge asked him, how much are your sales? $1.5 million. How much is the defendant's? $300,000. He says, you don't belong here. And that's a real problem. What is the point of a patent system where the little guy has to sell his soul to the devil, in other words, get an investor or sell out to the big company in order to enforce his patent?
That is a problem. That is a serious problem of the system, and it's because of over-discovery, over-advocacy, making a mountain out of every molehill. And the solution is difficult to come by. I don't have a solution. I'm sure there's a solution out there somewhere.
I think it is a problem. It's not unique to the patent system. I think it's a problem of, you know, to put on the mantle of the Federalist Society. It's the problem of big government. I mean, I think that we've made our cases generally, our litigation system generally has proliferated to a point where we just kind of have too much process. Now, ironically, I think the fix to that is process for cabining process, which is to say, if you're in court and you have no business being in court, the court ought to feel comfortable saying to you, hey, there's a cost to you for wasting our time and your opponent's time in court. And ironically, the so-called pro-patent Federal Circuit was leading the charge on Rule 11 in the Juden case. This is a case that came up through the Court of Claims. Remember, Rule 11 gets reviewed by the appellate court for abuse of discretion. The trial court decided not to grant Rule 11 sanctions. The Federal Circuit in the Juden case decided that it was not only appropriate to grant sanctions, but it was an abuse of discretion not to have granted sanctions, remanded to the trial court, to the federal claims court, for a subsequent hearing to allocate sanctions among the patentee, the patentee's trial lawyer, and the patentee's appellate lawyer. And so that's back in the day when everybody called the Federal Circuit pro-patent. So I think that the Federal Circuit itself took very, very seriously the concerns you're raising. I think that the question earlier about the presumption of validity, if you dial down the presumption of validity to the mere preponderance standard and you revived our case law to the pre-Seagate rule where fee shifting was available to the patentee, you would have fee shifting available symmetrically. And when fee shifting is available symmetrically, parties have incentives not to avoid litigation. I think you'll still see litigation rates the same, but I think litigation length and cost will drop precipitously because the moment you sue me over a case that I know is bogus, I will have a strong reason to send you a set of documents that will explain to you why your case is bogus, so that if we then stay in court, you're paying my fees. And, you know, maybe times three. So the exceptional case provision that's organic to Title 35 gives us a way to do that. 28 U.S.C. 1927 gives us a way to do that. Federal Rule Civil Procedure Rule 11 gives us a way to do that. There are several ways we can do it. I would encourage the Federal Circuit to, kind of look at all of them. I think those are ways to mitigate those risks, but they won't completely solve the problem.
I think that mitigates a different risk. I think that fee shifting will in fact cut down the amount of litigation because then the client who can't afford to litigate really can't afford to litigate because they may not only have to pay their own attorney, they may have to pay the other attorney also. I think that one solution, of course, is if both parties agree that they want to do it inexpensively, they can go to an arbitrator. I've arbitrated cases where we had no witnesses, just declarations and documents, and very, very limited discovery. But you give up a lot. You give up your advocacy. You give up your, what all trial lawyers love. But it can be done. You can, if the parties agree, a case can be arbitrated in that kind of. I'm doing one on Friday, and I will bet you that the two attorneys together don't have $150,000 in fees in the case. It's a license case. It's not a infringement case. It's a license case.
And
but it's a small dollar case, and so that's the way they're doing it.
I do. I mean, so I agree with that, and I mediate and arbitrate like Don. In fact, we work with some of the same people. There, for those of you who want to read up on this, we have a group on the web, www.fedarb.com. It's a group of former federal judges and some law professors and practitioners, and we try very hard to apply the federal rules of civil procedure to mediation, sorry, to arbitration. We even can form within our group appellate bodies to review. We think that it's a reasonable system for fairness. But I will point out, despite all of that connection, you know, and self-interest, that I think that it is a mistake to be an unmitigated fan of alternative dispute resolution. I think that there are times, and I'm not saying
no,
that I'm saying that. I think that there, we all have to recognize that there are times, if what you want is fast and less expensive, ADR is great. If what you want is, you know, purest form of fairness that we have in our society, it's our federal rules of civil procedure, which is long and expensive. That's why we pick them, right? That's why we, society, made them. They're more designed to get to what we think of as the right answer. Now, we all think that we do a good job as mediators and arbitrators, but we recognize that we're limited, that the professionals are our courts.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would agree with that. I think
we've heard our last word. We have to move out of this room pretty soon, but let's give a final applause for our panel.